My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of be talking to Geraldine Brooks. May I call you Geraldine? What do I call you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Geraldine is good? Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're here on the paperback tour for People of the Book, published by Penguin. I guess that's a Penguin, right?
That is indeed a Penguin.
Are you Australian?
I am.
I was wondering why your protagonist, Hannah, was Australian. I was just
so originally she wasn't, because the manuscript that is at the heart of the book is called the Sarajevo Haggadah, and I originally thought that the conservator who would be exploring the mysteries of this book would be Bosnian, and I was trying to get the voice of a Sarajevan, and it wasn't just coming together just quite right for me, because Sarajevans have a very distinctive bunch of things going on in the way they speak. Little bit of Ottoman politesse and a little bit of sort of...
still to this day?
Oh, yeah. Slavic soulfulness, and then a little sort of cynical mordant wit that probably came from shifting under communist regime for a while. So it was a lot of things happening that I just wasn't transmitting properly. Mm-hmm. And so I had to bin about 50 pages with that character. And now I'm thinking, what voice can I hear? What voice can I hear? Crikey.
And it's a Crocodile Dundee popped into your head, was that it?
Not just my own voice. She's got my voice. She doesn't, I rushed to say she doesn't have anything else much in common with me, but
okay.
It was a voice in my own head, the kind of Australian laconic.
Dark hair.
Thing.
She has dark hair.
She has dark hair, and she's interested in getting to the bottom of things.
Okay.
But she's got a mother from hell, which is not true for me. And she's kind of sexually reckless. Well, maybe we won't go there, but I'm not that way.
Is this a kind of a wish fulfillment that's going on with some of your characters?
No, it's just more fun to try and think your way into somebody who's not the same as you, as it is to just work over your own problems.
That's the fun of writing, because you create your own universe.
Exactly, yeah.
The Sarajevo Haggadah is a real thing. Maybe for those who of the uninitiated, we have to explain what a Haggadah is.
Yeah, it's the book, of course, that Jews use at the Passover table to retell the story of the Exodus and the liberation of the Hebrews from Egyptian slavery. And every Jewish home has one or has several. But the unique thing about the Sarajevo Haggadah is that it was created in Spain way back in around about 1450. And at that time, Jewish books typically weren't illustrated in any way because of the commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or likeness of anything. Mm-hmm. And yet this book's full of beautiful miniature paintings that are embellished with gold leaf and rich, rich pigments made out of malachite and lapis lazuli. So it's a real rarity.
When I was a kid, we had a Haggadah in the house. It was one of two common ones. It was a cheap one. It was a little paperback Haggadah. And there were illustrations in that also.
Oh, well, you know, after the Middle Ages, people got a lot less uptight about images. But until the Sarajevo Haggadah came to light in the 1890s, art historians thought that there was no figurative art at all among medieval Jews. And so this book made them have to go and reconsider that. And they've subsequently found quite a few illuminated Haggadot, and there were Jewish illuminators in small pockets of Europe, but it was highly unusual.
Well, at some point, the Jews always take on the protective coloration of the people around them and absorb the arts and mores to a certain degree of the people around them.
Well, yeah, and this was this time in Spain was known as convivencia, because it was a time when Muslims and Christians and Jews were living together, and if it wasn't exactly a love fest, it was a time of intellectual exchange and cross-fertilization. They had institutes for translation where Hebrew would be translated into Latin and Arabic and vice versa. So it was a fascinating time. Of course, like many of these times when we were all living together and celebrating difference, it fell apart rather dramatically with the coming of Ferdinand and Isabel and the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Spain.
Mm-hmm. People of the book has two parallel stories. One, the story of the Haggadah itself, and one, the story of Hannah Heath, who was a conservator and restores books.
Yeah, she's a medieval manuscript specialist.
And it's my understanding that the stories in this book, which are dated and go back in time as time, it jumps around a little bit, but they get old earlier and earlier as the book goes along, are based on real dates in the history of the Sarajevo Haggadah, yes?
Yeah, that's what I like to do. I like to follow the line of fact as far as it leads, and then it starts to fray and run out. And as a novelist, then I use my prerogative to imagine how it might have been. But we actually know some things. We know that this book has been rescued a number of times by unlikely rescuers. And the most recent was during the Bosnian War, when the ultranationalist fanatics were targeting not just the civilians of Sarajevo, but also the libraries and museums. And a Muslim librarian risked his neck to go in under heavy shelling and bring the book to a safe hiding place. And in World War II, likewise, a Muslim librarian saved it from the Nazis. And in Venice in 1609, we know a Catholic priest saved it from the book burnings of the Pope's Inquisition. So we don't know how it got out of Spain during the expulsion. So I was free to imagine a scenario for that.
Mm-hmm. You've imagined, a fictional history and provenance for this book.
Yes, I was interested in the people of the book, the creators and the protectors through time.
People of the book is also a term used for the Jews.
And the Muslims.
And the Muslims.
Yeah, it's in the hadith of Muhammad. He talks of the Ahl al-Khattab. And I don't know whether he picked it up from the Jews or vice versa, but it basically refers to Christians also, the people who have a sacred text at the heart of their religious faith, be it Quran or Torah or Bible.
Mm-hmm. And at one point, the Muslims were protective and tolerant of anybody who was in the book.
And supposedly that still holds, but not always.
There's been some breaches.
There have been some breaches.
The manuscript emerges in Sarajevo, and Hannah is called to exercise her talents and her gifts, her training, on reserving the book, and she takes a look at it. And one of the things about it I found interesting is that it was whatever covers the book had at one time, it's now in nondescript kind of plain covers.
Yes, that was the thing. So I actually was able to go to Sarajevo and be a witness when a real book conservator was working on the manuscript. And it was quite an experience because this book had been locked away in a safe for decades, and nobody had really seen it. And so when they were going to bring it out of its hiding place, it was quite a song and dance. There were all kinds of guards there from the bank and from the museum and from the Sarajevo police and from the UN peacekeeping forces. So there are about 10 burly guys in this diminutive book restorer in this room, and then they come with this box, and it's all sealed shut, and it's tied up with strings, and two different officials have to witness the opening of the box, and then they finally bring out the book, and it's wrapped in silk, and they have to unwrap it, and then they put it down in this specially prepared table, and you go, all this for that? Because it's a daggy-looking little thing. It's something you'd see in a used bookstore and not even pick up. The covers are smeared and dirty and nondescript cardboard. And then the conservator opens it to the illuminations, and you just go, whoosh. You know, the color is as vibrant as the day it was put down, and the illuminations are so beautiful and so engaging. And then you realize why that people risk their neck for this book. But a book like that would originally have had very lovely binding, but obviously at some point that wore out and was discarded. And we know it was rebound in Vienna in the 1890s in an inappropriate style.
Well, it depends. If you were trying to hide it, that would be a wonderful way to hide it.
Yeah, I don't think they were at that time, so it's a bit of a mystery why they did such a botched job on it. But could have been anti-Semitism, which was getting pretty hot in Vienna at that time.
Yeah, there's a tradition of anti-Semitism in Vienna. Going back well into the 19th century, there were anti-Semitic political parties in Vienna. You could run for mayor of Vienna as an anti-Semite.
Yeah, it was in reaction to the fact that in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Jews had done remarkably well, even in non-traditional spheres, like the Austro-Hungarian army had an officer corps that was becoming quite heavily Jewish. And so that fed the anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And it was the same time Hitler was growing up, not very far out of town, actually. So it's a very interesting time. But you had huge Jewish intellects like Freud and Mahler and all these people sort of banging into each other on street corners. So it was a very interesting time to write about.
Yeah, I once did some research on the Cabaret of Berlin in the 1920s, and it turns out it really had its antecedents in places like Vienna 40 years before that. Mm. That these kind of anti-government, rude, funny, satirical, somewhat nasty little bits have been going on in Eastern Europe for a lot longer than that.
So, right.
Yeah. There are Hanna finds clues within the pages of the book.
Yeah, and this is something that book conservators do, and I hadn't realized that they have to be such detectives. But if you find any little bit of matter that's been trapped in the binding, it can tell you a lot. And I talked to conservators who'd found quill pairings or fragment of insect or something like that, or a breadcrumb. If you chemically analyze it, it can tell you what kind of wheat the bread was made from, and that can place the book for you in a certain location. So I played with that, and I have my fictional conservator find fictional artifacts like a white hair and a fragment of a butterfly wing trapped in the pages of the book, and each of those things takes us on the journey back in time.
I don't want to give away too much of your plot here, but there's one thing I want to mention which I thought was kind of fun. To find wine stains on a Haggadah is no big deal because wine is a big part of the ritual for the Seder.
Exactly.
And it gets drunk several times. So yes, Not having wine stains on Haggadah is, I mean, you know, it's just like a 50-50 chance it's going to be there.
Yeah.
But you create an entire different story of how those wine stains got there. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
So I decided to use the wine stains, which are actually on the Sarajevo Haggadah, to explore what happened to the book in Venice in 1609. And we know that this Catholic priest called Vistarini saved the book because he signed his name to it and said there was nothing against the teaching of the Catholic Church, and otherwise it would have been burnt. And I was trying to find out about who these Catholic Hebraists were, and that led me to an autobiography of a Venetian rabbi of that era who had actually had to go several times to plead for books to the Inquisition office. So I imagined a friendship between these two guys and what the limits of that friendship might be. Mm-hmm. In the Venice of that period. And, you know, there's so many things I didn't know when I started doing this book, but one of them was that ghetto is a word that we get from Venice. That was the original ghetto. Mm, that the Jews were given a little island where they had to live, and it had been an iron foundry. So
I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Geraldine Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S. Title of the book is People of the Book, and it's published by Penguin. When I was in Venice, I was there for a few days, and I made it a point to go see the ghetto. And it's a little island with one bridge on and one bridge off. Mm. And it's very easy to keep all the Jews there because all you need is one guard at each bridge, and you can bottle all the people up. And they were permitted to go out during the day to do their business, but they had to come back at night. After dark, they had to be back in the ghetto. And the thing that's astonishing to me is that the whole thing is about the size of a city block. And at one time, there were 25,000 people living in the ghetto. The place amazed me. Did you have the same feeling?
Exactly. You really feel the press of their ghosts. It's one of those places where history still feels very, very proximate. And you imagine, it's not that way now, but you imagine the density And you see the flimsy, you know, the walls that people built because they had to go up. They had nowhere else to go. So the buildings on the ghetto aisle were the highest buildings in Venice at that time. And people were really literally cheek by jowl. And they weren't, it wasn't a homogenous population by any means, because Jews were coming there from all over Europe because it was the best place. I mean, it was no picnic. You had to live in a ghetto. You had to wear a red or a yellow hat when you went out. You were despised, but you had the protection of the law, which was a very big deal. And you could actually, you know, you're allowed to exercise certain professions. And these were rights that Jews didn't typically have in Christian Europe at that time.
Venice is one of my favorite places on earth. Not just the fact that they don't even allow bicycles on the streets there, never mind cars. And it's a city for walking around and everything. You can touch the buildings on both sides sometimes, even a little guy like me. There's some presence there that I find really amazing. And apparently everybody feels it because
it's just spectacularly beautiful. I mean, that was another great pleasure of doing this book, was having an excuse
to go to Venice.
I have to go to Venice. And we arrived, actually, it was almost magical. I took my one of my sons with me, and we had flown all night, and we came in across the canal at dawn, and you just see the shape of the skyline shimmering in front of you. It was absolutely fantastic. Happened to be Christmas Day. And we arrived in St. Mark's Square right as they're ringing the bells for Christmas Day at noon. And I couldn't figure out what the sound was at first, because it was as if the whole earth was humming. It was just the most incredible, deep, resonant sound. It was magnificent.
And you can cross the real Bridge of Sighs.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't know that such a place actually existed.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole literature of there are at least three that I can think of, mystery series that are all set in Venice.
Uh-huh.
At various times during World War II, and ancient times or medieval times, mm, really, and a modern series as well. Mm. Something about that place that just draws people.
Well, I think, you know, authors are looking for another excuse why they have to go back there.
Go back to Venice, yeah.
For research.
I would do it in a second.
I have to research that angel hair pasta with shaved truffles again.
Ooh. Let me talk about some of the characters in the book. Hannah's mother is a piece of work. She's vain, talented, brilliant. She's a surgeon, a neurosurgeon, and considers her daughter to be a major disappointment because all she has is a PhD who potches around with paper and paste. Talk a little. I forget her name. What's her mom's name?
Sarah.
Yeah. Tell us about her.
So she's a emotionally stunted individual who lives for her work, and there's a lot of mystery about who the father was. Sarah doesn't feel that Hannah has a right to that information. And she really wants this child that she's raised to be in her image. And when Hannah goes a different direction, she never can really accept the validity of her choices. And I kind of based her on some things that friends had told me who have, parents who are in the medical field and who really want their kids to follow them because they love their work so much and they think it's the most worthwhile thing on earth. And then, you know, I just kind of interrogated other friends who I know have troubled relationships with their parents to try and get a feel for what that might be like, because fortunately I had a very good relationship with my parents and they always just wanted me to do whatever I wanted to do. So it's kind of harrowing, but Hannah's not guilt-free in this too. She repulses all her mother's efforts to repair the damage at times.
Yeah, they don't get along.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a guy, the wonderfully named Amitai Yom Tov. Yom Tov is Yontif in Yiddish. It means holiday. So on Yom Kippur, you say to somebody, good Yontif.
Yeah, well, it's literally good day.
Good day.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Yom Tov, good day, right.
I actually know an Israeli with that name, and I've always loved it.
Did you get his permission to use his name?
I didn't, because I didn't give him the same first name.
So. Okay. Well, he's an Israeli who also has a interest, let's say, in the Sarajevo Haggadah. There's also Werner Heinrich, who's her teacher, that Hannah's teacher and mentor. And he figures in the end, because as we're going through the book, I'm thinking, well, okay, this is all very nice. And then suddenly you hit us with a mystery at the end. I'm not going to tell anybody what it is, but...
Well, the thing was that I first heard about the Sarajevo Haggadah when I was working as a journalist before I'd become a novelist. And I was in the city during the siege. And at that point, the Haggadah was considered missing because nobody knew that this Muslim librarian had taken it to a safe hiding place. It just was gone. And there were all kinds of rumors swirling about what might have happened to it. And one of them was that Mossad had sent a team to bring it to a safe place. And I was talking to the leading Hebrew manuscript specialist from Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he said, yeah, you know, actually somebody came to me with a harebrained scheme like that. And he said, I told them to go away. But, you know, that got my novelist juices flowing. So.
And just because he told them to go away doesn't mean somebody else did.
Well, it didn't. This is fiction. But yeah. I had some fun imagining what might have happened in that regard.
So here's a question. You have all these compelling little stories of the history of the Haggadah, going back into Venice and Sarajevo and places in Spain during the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella. When you were putting the book together, did you ever feel that maybe Hannah's modern story wasn't as compelling as some of the older stories?
Hannah wasn't meant to be such a big part of the book. I originally envisioned the conservative character would introduce the mysteries of the book, and then she would stand politely to one side and let the historical action unfold and then come in for a curtsy at the end. But
once
I made her Australian, I don't know if you've ever had an Australian house guest.
Yeah. Oh, I used to have an Australian girlfriend.
Oh, well, you know all about it then. You know, they come for the weekend and a month later they're still sleeping on the couch.
Fortunately, she wasn't sleeping on the couch, but yeah,
right.
I know
right.
what you mean.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But so Hannah had such a big personality that she insisted on having her own plot. So it was kind of out of my hands.
Don't you love it the way the characters take on a life of their own?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's one of the best things about the creative process is when the characters start doing things you hadn't planned for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's always a risk when you have multiple narratives in a book that people will find one more compelling than the other. And some people have opined that they prefer the historical sections, but others really like Hannah and really find the book conservation stories and plot fascinating. So, you know, you win some, you lose some.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to top a story of a Yugoslavian partisan in World War II or a rabbi in the during the Inquisition.
Definitely, yeah.
Mm. The term converso comes up in the book, and this is not a term that most people are, no pun intended, conversant with. tell us about the conversos.
So the Fernando and Isabella, they really wanted to make Spain into a Christian nation once they had conquered all the different principalities. And the idea was the Jews had a choice. They could become Christian and stay, or they had to leave their homeland. And so a lot of Jews converted in inverted commas, but they continued to practice their religion in secret. And so you have all these kind of secret rooms where people would go, and that's where they kept their Hebrew books, or they would secrete the mezuzah that you put on the door, and they'd put it in the toe of the Madonna statue, so it looked like they were touching the toe of the Madonna when they were really fulfilling the mitzvah to touch the mezuzah.
I knew some people who came from Mexico, and we were talking about conversos once. They said, oh, you know, we heard something about it, but I don't know anything about that personally. And she said, did your mother light candles on Friday night? And she said, yeah, how did you know that? I said, because that's one of the sure signs that you like what the church called inappropriate candle lighting, you know, on Friday nights when only Jews would do a thing like that. They hid the rituals quite well, and they maintained whatever outward appearance they needed to. A lot of them wound up in Mexico.
Yeah, and it's interesting now that everybody's checking out their DNA. Spanish DNA, so many people turn up Jewish forebears. Mm-hmm. So not everybody left by any means.
Yeah, as an Ashkenazi Jew, I've always been fascinated with the Sephardim anyway, the other Jews, the Jews from Southern Europe and North Africa and the Middle East. I lived in New York, and I only met one Sephardic family in all the time I lived in New York. So they're like the mystery people to us.
Yeah, well, that's a huge part of the population of Israel, of course, now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how different rituals and the songs and so forth are, but I think
the words are the same, the melodies are different.
Well, the words are not always the same, because there's a wonderful, you know, as Ashkenazi Jews have Yiddish, Sephardic Jews have Ladino, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful language that's related to early Spanish dialects. And what happened when they were rich, they were influential, they really were running the show in Spain in many cases. They were so close to the royal family, and they were the professionals and the doctors, and yet when they were expelled, the hardships of that exile were so great that Sephardic Jews typically were very poor. In Sarajevo, it was a very poor Jewish community, not particularly well educated. That's sort of the opposite of what we think of as the assimilated Ashkenazi Jew. Mm-hmm. Really, the Sephardi Jews never quite recovered from the trauma of the expulsion.
We wept by the waters of Babylon. Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Another story about faith and crisis. But this time it's very close to home. I live on the island of Martha's Vineyard, and I found out that the first Native American graduate of Harvard was a Martha's Vineyard Wampanoag Indian. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I wonder what year that was. Probably around 1974, I was guessing, 1665. So now I'm writing about first contact on Martha's Vineyard and the traditional belief system of the Indians coming into contact with Christian Puritans.
Martha's Vineyard's a fur piece from Canberra.
It is. That's what happens when you travel the world and fall in love with foreigners.
Well, we're happy to have you here. I've been talking with Geraldine Brooks. Geraldine is the author of People of the Book, published by Penguin. Please come back again.
I'd love to.